The Guardian.
I'm Simon Baron-Cohen, and I'm the director of the Autism Research Centre at Cambridge University.
Simon, what was your motivation for writing Zero Degrees of Empathy?
Partly, I was wanting to see what the scientific approach should be to understanding why human beings commit acts of cruelty. So cruelty is part of our everyday experience, and we hear awful stories in the news all the time. But when you look at how science explains human cruelty, there's actually a dearth of approaches. And in the everyday understanding of why people do bad things, often people resort to the concept of evil, that when somebody, for example, commits murder or commits a rape or some other awful event, the person, the aggressor, is said to be evil. And the media does it, even the court system sometimes does it. But when you look at the concept of evil, it's not really an explanation. To say this person did something bad because they're evil, in a way, is a bit circular. You know, we're using the word evil as the opposite of good. Mm. And it's like saying somebody did something bad because they're bad.
Mm.
So as a scientist, it's unsatisfying. You want an explanation that can take you deeper, that can give you some sort of analysis, and leads to predictions.
You opened the book with some quite striking discussions with your father as when you were a child, and I wonder if you could just tell us about those and whether there were any influence on your interest in this area.
Sure. The passage that you're referring to in my book is when my father told me when I was about 7 years old that the Nazis had turned Jews into lampshades. And just listening to that phrase, the idea of turning a person into an object, is something that stuck with me as a child. He also told me, other stories about what the Nazis did to different minorities. But the commonality seemed to be that when human beings act in a cruel way, they treat other people as objects.
Hmm.
But for me, what's nagged away at me all these years and now decades is how can human beings turn off their empathy, their compassion for a fellow human being, so that they can just treat them as an object? And as a neuroscientist, I also am interested to know what's going on in the brain when we can lose our feelings, our compassion for somebody else, and do awful things.
You talk about there being this sort of historical problem where there's no good explanation for evil and cruelty really are, even though we recognise them when we see them. I mean, has this area been neglected by science? Has it left it to religious and other domains?
I think religion has tried to explain acts of cruelty for centuries, so they've had a head start on science. It's not that science has completely neglected it, it's just that it's looked at it in very isolated topics. So, for example, the psychopath, to give it its full name, psychopathic personality disorder, and also called antisocial personality disorder, that's been well studied by researchers, but it's just one particular example of a group of individuals who can end up doing nasty things to other people. So the mind of the psychopath and ultimately the brain of a psychopath and even some of the genetic influences leading to psychopathy, they have been well studied, but in my book I broaden it so it's not just a focus on psychopaths. It's looking at what are the different ways in which you can lose your empathy. And being a psychopath is just one of those routes.
Can you talk a bit about where empathy does come in as your attempt to explain evil? What is it that, when you talk about losing empathy, are we talking about an absolute loss, about a permanent loss? And is this something, as you say, there are different shades of losing empathy. Can I lose it in one circumstance compared to another, depending on which part of my neural circuitry is not working properly?
Well, that's right. So basically what I've done is try to shift the debate away from these rather theological concepts like evil onto what I would argue is more scientific concepts like empathy. I think the concept of empathy is more explanatory. And that's because you can isolate it in the brain. In my book, I call it the empathy circuit, which is a network of at least 10 regions that seem to be involved when we empathize. But secondly, it's joining acts of cruelty to all of us in the population. So we all have empathy, it's normative. And in the book, I talk about an empathy bell curve or a spectrum, that we're all somewhere on this spectrum. It's not that you either have empathy or you don't, but we, you know, there are individual differences in there. And part of what the book explores is what contributes to where a person ends up on that bell curve.
And do you feel, as a psychologist and a neuroscientist, that there is good evidence for this, for the empathy circuit? I mean, there's a lot of discussion around the validity of certain types of brain scans and such like, but do you think science is getting a meaningful handle on empathy and the consequences of the lack of it?
Mm. I'm the first to acknowledge that brain scanning and MRI has lots of limitations. Mm. All you really see is patterns of blood flow in the brain whilst the person is doing a task. That's functional MRI. But nevertheless, you know, using that technology, we have got some consistent results coming out, isolating or identifying particular regions of the brain. So the amygdala is one, and another is called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. So these are just two examples of regions in the brain that make up what seems to be a growing consensus in neuroscience of regions involved in empathy.
So how does an unempathic person behave differently to what we might call a sort of a normal person? I mean, how does it, because a lack of empathy might seem something that could actually be quite hard to detect unless someone's in a certain situation.
Well, one point is that a lack of empathy doesn't necessarily lead a person to be cruel. So if you have low empathy, or what I sometimes call 0 degrees of empathy, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to do bad things to other people. It may be that it leads you to avoid other people because you find them confusing, that you find social relationships really difficult to figure out. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll go the step further and hurt other people. So the way it could express itself, to answer your question, is that someone with low empathy might just put their foot in it all the time. Mm. They might say the wrong thing, they might do the wrong thing, they might be perceived as socially very clumsy, but not necessarily as hurtful. If someone has low empathy, I would argue that that is necessary but not sufficient for them to commit acts of cruelty. So when you hear of someone who kills another person, I would say that by definition, it means that their empathy circuit has gone down, whether it's temporarily or permanently, but it's not functioning. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been capable of committing that act. So low empathy or 0 degrees of empathy is necessary to explain actions like that. But it's not sufficient, because there are plenty of people who have low empathy who don't, as you say, commit acts of aggression. I think low empathy can mean that you don't have brakes on your behavior. So by itself, it can explain, for example, why someone else punches another person or pulls the trigger. Mm. I don't think you need to resort to other factors to explain. I mean, I think 0 degrees of empathy alone could be an explanation, but it's not sufficient to explain why the range of people who have low empathy don't go on to commit acts of cruelty. You're also raising the question about, you know, what are the different ways that you could lose your empathy? Mm. Well, you could lose it in a temporary way, a transient shutdown, if you like. So when any of us get tired or stressed or depressed, we could lose our empathy in the sense that we focus on ourselves, on our own immediate needs and goals, and may lose sight of other people's feelings and thoughts. But you could also lose your empathy in more enduring ways, more permanent ways. And I explore different examples of that from medicine, and particularly psychiatry.
And this was a lot to do with coming back to perhaps a classic of childhood experiences.
Well, childhood influences are one set of risk factors. So particularly attachment. So the infant's emotional attachment to their caregiver It's an old theory, attachment theory. It goes back to John Bowlby. He really emphasized that if a child experiences affection and nurturing parenting in the first few years of life, that effectively it protects them from all kinds of difficulties later. In contrast, if you have a child who experiences the absence of affectionate parenting, for example, if they experience neglect or abuse, that can be a big risk factor for losing your empathy later. And Bowlby famously focused on delinquents, so teenagers mostly, adolescents who were getting into trouble for antisocial behaviour, hurting other people, stealing, setting fire, all kinds of acts of hurting others, really, and really picking out that one thing they shared in common was an insecure attachment. They lacked the trusting relationship between an infant and a reliable, loving caregiver.
This comes to my next question, actually, which is about where your argument leaves personal responsibility. In reading some of the case studies in your books, these are people who have gone through extraordinarily awkward, awful times as children, or have had they were bullied, abused, and all manner of things as they were growing up. Where does that leave them as responsible for their actions as an unempathic adult?
Sure. I mean, what we're really asking here is about free will.
Yeah.
You know, and whether people should be held responsible for their actions when they hurt another person. And if it's the case that you can end up with low empathy, with your empathy circuit being underactive, or in structural terms, maybe regions of the brain being less developed because of your early experience or because of your genes or other aspects of your biology, then in some ways, rather than holding the individual responsible, we should perhaps see them like we do other disabilities. So if someone is in a wheelchair, we don't hold them responsible for their physical disability. And the book is raising these questions. You know, we may need to use the criminal justice system when someone hurts another person, but equally we could take a compassionate view of the aggressor, and say, well, their own behavior itself is the product of both genes and environment. So we could take a more compassionate view of offenders and maybe be thinking about them in the health service rather than the criminal justice service.
Do you think there is a lack of empathic people at the top of business, at religion and things like this? And I'm thinking about your example in the book of Desmond Tutu being extraordinarily empathic in the past. And I'm wondering if there are... if there is a lack of people of sufficient empathy at the top that would actually be meaningful to make a difference, if you like.
Well, my book does have a partly political angle to it, or agenda even, in that it's arguing that empathy is a neglected resource. I even say that empathy is, you know, the most important human resource we have, because we can use it to resolve conflict, whether we're talking about domestic conflict or whether we're talking about international conflict. And the problem, I suppose, is that we get into speculation. We don't really know what the empathy levels are of our political leaders. And the example I hold up of someone with very high empathy, Desmond Tutu, again, it's speculation. From his behavior, we could infer that he must have extraordinary levels of empathy to have chaired the Truth and Reconciliation hearings and to have really understood the pain of the victims who needed to be able to disclose their feelings. But we haven't put Desmond Tutu into the scanner, nor have we put our current Prime Minister or other presidents into the scanner. And it may be that our political system would look very different if we, instead of using, say, legal methods for resolving conflict or military methods for resolving conflict, we prioritized empathy as a tool for resolving conflict.
And do you have any thoughts on where, if it were desirable, if society deemed it desirable to raise the empathy levels of certain parts of society or even society as a whole? I mean, are there mechanisms for doing that kind of thing? Or maybe looking at it another way, are there habits or problems that society develops that reduce empathy?
I think if we just take a historical perspective, it's been going on for some time. So if you look at the design of classrooms in primary schools, if you went back to the 1950s or 60s, children sat in rows of desks and they didn't talk and they just stared at the teacher who was the authority figure and stayed silent. And today the classroom in a primary school is a much more social place that young children work in groups, they communicate, they learn to share. There's very much an emphasis on collaboration and communication. So there's already been a structural change in the design of classrooms. Of course, not all children find it easy to socialise and work in groups and collaborate. So I think we could be looking at doing even more within the educational system to foster empathy. But it's just one example of how we can make structural changes to our institutions, which can have benefits, including nurturing empathy in children and adults.
Does empathy vary across communities or even across generations? Has there been enough studies on empathy to know whether it is higher in a certain part of the world or a certain generation?
As a scientist, I would have to say that those studies haven't been done as far as I know. So the question is, would they be interesting or desirable to compare, let's say, one generation with another or one ethnic group with another? Personally, I'd be a bit concerned about the comparison of ethnic groups in terms of empathy, because it could easily lead to stereotyping. But it is, I think, of interest to know whether the population is changing in their empathy levels.
Very finally, you're probably more well known for your work on autism, and I was interested in how that research feeds into the work in your current book.
Well, my work in autism in some ways was the other route into this book. So I've been working in the field of autism for more than 20 years. And one of the cardinal characteristics of autism is difficulties with empathy, difficulties in appreciating other people's perspectives, and particularly in interpreting other people's behavior in terms of their thoughts and feelings. And part of what the book does is to try to understand what's the relationship between, say, people with autism who have difficulties with empathy and these other psychiatric groups like the personality disorders who also have difficulties with empathy. And it allows me to, in the book, to see that one common factor is this empathy circuit in the brain, that it applies to people with autism just as much as to the groups with personality disorders, borderline personality disorder, even applying to the rest of us in the population. It's the same circuit that seems to be implicated when our empathy levels vary. But empathy in autism is the subject of another discussion in the book, because in people with autism, alongside their difficulties with empathy, they seem to also have a different style of processing information. They tend to focus on details, and they tend to focus on patterns and what I call systems or rule-based patterns. So they have a talent at spotting patterns such that they can sometimes understand things at a greater level, show precocious development in figuring out how things work. And that may be part of what contributes to their low empathy, because the social world is very difficult to systemize. People's feelings are very difficult to reduce to a set of rules, unlike, for example, a computer.
You're a male scientist. Where does that put you on the spectrum of empathy?
Well, as you say, we're all on that empathy spectrum. I haven't actually taken the empathy tests myself, partly because I'm involved in designing them. So I sort of know the answers. But, you know, taking me out of the question, I think that there are sex differences on average in empathy, and there are many studies which have looked at this. So even using questionnaires, like the empathy quotient, females on average score higher than males. So that's one way to look at subgroups in the population. And you're absolutely right that scientists as a group on average tend to score slightly lower in terms of empathy than those in the humanities or the communication fields.
Simon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.